From WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Two recent big developments in the world of tablet computers. Apple unveiled the iPad Mini, and Amazon launched Whispercast for the Kindle, a service designed to manage content for thousands of devices in use by businesses and schools. In fact, tablets seem like the perfect gadget for the 21st century classroom, a device not a whole lot bigger than a Pop-Tart with a world of knowledge packed inside. Those young digital natives, they do love it, but adults, they're not so sure. This hour on Point, mobile technology, tablets, and the challenge of building the best 21st century classroom. You can join the conversation. Parents, teachers, are there iPads or Kindles in your school? Are you embracing them or not? Well, joining me first this hour is Shane Evans. He's director of the University of Chicago Charter School and managing director of the University of Chicago's Urban Education Institute. He's been working for years to modernize public schools and is now supervising the introduction of iPads into four charter schools, one elementary, two middle school, and one high school, all on Chicago's South Side. He's also the father of a six-year-old girl. Shane Evans, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hello, Meghna. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a true pleasure. Well, let me start first off by saying that Chicago has really been one of the sort of focal points of this tablet in schools revolution. I recall that last year, back in 2011, when Steve Jobs was introducing the iPad 2, he even featured the fact that in Chicago public schools, there was this claim that iPads had already, provided a boost in test scores as high as 50% to 60% in reading, math, and science. I mean, that came from a claim from Chicago Public Schools tech director John Connolly. So we'll talk in a little bit about what's going on specifically in Chicago that is drawing people so much attention. But take us inside your classrooms in the charter schools that you run. How are tablets being used today?
Fantastic. So the University of Chicago Charter School has four campuses, two elementaries actually, one middle and one high school. And we've been using a one-to-one laptop platform for about 8 years in our middle school, and it's really revolutionized what we do on a day-to-day basis.
So the kids are already used to having technology at their fingertips with the laptops.
Exactly. Starting in 2004, we started a lease program for our students and families, where as a part of their school fee, they would get access to a MacBook laptop. Students could take that home. They could use it for homework. They used it during the day. They used it in all of their classes. The laptop traveled with them, and students used it in both 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. It changed the way that we approached doing school in some formats.
Okay, so you've got experience with sort of that one-on-one technology in the classrooms. Now, talk to me about the tablets, about the iPads and the Kindles. What classrooms are they in, and how are teachers specifically using them? Any particular apps that that really jump out at you as being effective teaching tools?
Absolutely. And we can look at the different types of apps that are available on either the iPad or different tablets from grades K to 12. One example is Notability. This is an app that's available both for laptops and for tablets and smartphones, and it enables students to record classes. They can take notes. They can write freehand. They can use as almost a digital graphic organizer to keep all of their information, all of their thoughts about a class, a topic, or standard or skill. And you can all have it in one place. You can email it to yourself. It can be shared across different platforms. It could be shared across your smartphone or your laptop. It's a great way for students to organize their notes and thoughts.
How far has this digital learning, this tablet-based learning gone? I mean, am I off base when I'm imagining myself in one of your classrooms, and, you know, is there a tablet on every student's desks? Are they all sort of individually working, or is there some sort of group activities that are going on around the apps? I mean, if I were to parachute in to, you know, a math class or something, what would I be seeing?
Absolutely. We're still experimenting with what this looks like from grades K to 12. In a high school classroom, in maybe a 9th grade classroom or a 10th grade classroom at our high school, you'll see students with a one-to-one iPad platform that they take out of actually iPad carts. And again, each student would have an iPad. They're using it to take notes. They're using it to get on Google Docs or Google Drive. They're using it to do research, and they're using it to also complete projects in their engineering classes. In the lower elementary grades, we have iPads that we can share among classes, or we can use them as workstations. And you might see students on something like SparkNotes, or you might also see students on an app called Study Island. And the Study Island app is great. It's a web-based platform, Meghna, and it allows students to get repetition and skill based learning, so they get more reps around specific math skills, science skills, or reading skills. Mm-hmm. That starts as early as kids with ages 8, 9, 10, and 11, and it's a way to give them individualized instruction.
So are some of these classrooms textbook free? I mean, is it all digital?
No, it's both. And I think that's one of the things that it's important that we talk about, both as far as tablets and iPads, but also as far as traditional print books and textbooks. I think the best classrooms in the 21st century will have a combination of both. It's not either or anymore. It's definitely both and.
Shane Evans, let's sort of jump to the bottom line here that I know a lot of people are already wondering about. I talked a little bit earlier about a claim from Chicago Public Schools tech director John Connolly last year that iPads helped some of the students in other schools gain 50 to 60% in reading, math, and science scores. Have you, in your charter schools, seen that same bump?
That's a large jump. So first and foremost, I'll just start with the belief that standardized tests aren't the only way that we measure students' intelligence, of course, right? As we look into a 21st century world, we realize that some of the things that we assess on standardized tests won't really assess our ability to work well with technology, for instance. So we want to make sure that we know that there's different types of aptitudes. That being said, over the past 3 years, University of Chicago Charter Schools have shown improvement on the ISAT exam, and we've jumped up about 7 percentage points overall on reading, math, and science over the past 3 years.
Do you attribute that to the use of technology and to the iPads or the laptops?
I would say that the use of technology is one lever. It's not the only lever as the reason why we've seen this kind of increase, but we definitely think it helps. And the second thing I'd also say, Meghna, is that as we are in the 21st century and we see that there's an achievement gap already in traditional learning, what we want to make sure for urban students, for Black and brown students, or students across the nation, really, that are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, that there doesn't become a technology gap.
A digital divide.
A digital divide, that students from all socioeconomic backgrounds have access and experience with the same type of platforms that their middle class and upper class counterparts might have.
Now, this seems to me for your students to be extraordinarily important, because is it fair to say that you know, if you didn't have this technology, these tablets in the classroom, that they may not have as much access as other families?
So in 2004, 2005, that would definitely be the case. At that point, as you remember, and I'm sure our listeners remember, the cost for either a laptop or even a desktop computer was extreme. Now in 2012, we're seeing these prices fall, right? The Kindle's under $200. The iPad mini is $329. Laptops themselves start at $399, $499. So it's much more accessible. At the same time, we want to make sure that our students, and 83% of our students would qualify for free or reduced lunch. 99% of our students are African American, and most of our students come from the South Side of Chicago. We want to make sure that there isn't a digital divide, so that if parents want to sign up at our middle school or our high school for a laptop program or use of the technology, they have access to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shane Evans, let's take a little step back here, because you know, I am putting myself in the shoes of a parent who might be saying, yes, technology is absolutely a part of young people's lives and their world, and it'll be even more so as time goes by. But we see how those digital natives, they just take to it instantly. And quite frankly, there's a huge amount of content and distraction that comes along with those iPads or those Kindles. So, I mean, are they actually learning things, or are those kids, you know, maybe when the teacher isn't looking, spending a lot of time on Facebook?
That's a great question, and I think that's a real concern. I think first and foremost, when we start thinking about technology, Meghna, we have to think about engagement, right? So schools need to do a better job on the front end of making sure that all of their students are engaged in the first place. Engagement has been a problem in schools since the 20th century, since the 19th century. We've always thought about being in a classroom and looking outside the window and thinking about recess or thinking about the baseball practice after school. That's always been a challenge. Are we going to read a comic book or are we going to read our social studies textbook, right? So our teachers were always trying to kind of manage our expectations and our interests. So I don't think that technology is to blame for the lack of schools' ability to really get students excited about learning. That's number one. But in on the ground, if a student has a laptop or a student has a tablet or a smartphone, sure, they could be anywhere in the world rather than paying attention to the lesson on exponents. So the best teachers find ways to incorporate learning into what students want to do, but they also then have management systems for the use of technology so that they can oversee what's happening in the classroom. So for instance, that could be the way that you set your classroom up. So instead of having all your students in rows, maybe you have all the desks facing the windows, right? And you can see everyone's screen.
Right? Always so someone looking over your shoulder.
there's always Big Brother in the classroom looking to see what you're doing, number one. But number two, just like in the workplace, and I know this sounds different, but if we're going to teach our young people to be critical thinkers, but to also be responsible for their own learning, just like in the workplace from 9 to 5, I'm assuming your boss isn't necessarily looking over your shoulder.
I hope
he not. Or she, right? Right, well, we think not.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the increasing number of tablets in schools across the country and the best way to teach kids in the 21st century and whether the computer tablet is education's killer app. I'm joined by Shane Evans. He's in Chicago and he's the director of the University of Chicago Charter School. He's been introducing iPads into 4 Chicago public schools. And Shane, just before the break, I had to cut you off there. We were talking about trying to control the potential of distractions in the classroom with the iPads or the tablets. And we've got some comments already on this at onpointradio.org. Marcus Six wrote to us. He said, "I love the idea of being able to link to external sites to drill down into related areas while a lecture is going on. However, I do wonder how much emailing, messaging, and surfing through Facebook, sports scores, etc. will go on. He himself teleconferences all the time, and he is tempted to check email or some other unrelated site when that's happening." So what's that second point you were going to make about controlling distraction through the tablets in the classroom?
So absolutely. Again, Meghna, there are ways that I think the best teachers that are experimenting with technology in their classrooms are finding to do that now. So there are platforms on the Mac, for instance, in our operating system. You can actually see all of your students' screens if you would like to. So you can pull up all 25 or all 30 students' screens at any time to see where they're at. At the same time, if you're using a platform like Compass Learning or Study Island, you can also monitor what students are doing, which questions they're working on, how long it takes for them to answer the questions, which questions they got right, which ones they got wrong. Another example of how you can monitor this is, remember when we were in English class, we might have read a certain text and all of a sudden we were having a classroom discussion about it. And Meghna, let's say that took 15 minutes, right? Well, first of all, how many students actually participated in that whole group discussion during that 15 minutes?
I guess it depends.
It just depends, right? And at the same time, how do you assess that every student had read the text and also understands the crucial points? Well, let's say that you're doing a Google app and you've got a chat going, right? You got a chat room for your classroom and you've got your 25 kids and you've got them separated into 5 groups of 5. The teacher then could join each chat room and then you could post your questions in the chat room. Students then type their answers. All of a sudden, all 25 students are participating at the same time. In that 15 minutes, you're getting kids to respond to 3, 4, 5, 6 types of questions. You can see who's typing, who's not. You can see who's participating. You can see that Meghna said something amazing, and all I said was, yeah, I agree. And then you've actually got a transcript of that 15-minute conversation that the teacher could then go back and assess, give a grade. You could check in and say, hey, Shane, I noticed that all you said was you just really agreed with Meghna the whole time. Mm. What did you really think about the autobiography of Malcolm X?
But in order to really sort of connect the activities in those chat room, it still requires a teacher to sort of to follow through and to be there face-to-face and say, hey, I saw you were sort of engaged, but let's take that to the next level and prove to me that you've learned something.
Well, and isn't it exactly the case that that's what we have to do currently in classrooms, Meghna, right? So if I was lecturing, I'd be looking at my students and I'd look at my 25 and I'd see who's with me and not or not. I'd check in to see whose hands were raised and I'd call on certain people. The best teachers say, hey, Meghna, I haven't heard from you yet. Why don't you take number 7? You know, Shane, can you expound on that? I know you have something to say to that. And that's what we would do without technology. So it's also using some of the same techniques and strategies that we've had in the past and adjust them to this current platform.
Shane Evans, I'm going to ask you to stand by because we've got so many people who across the country have a lot to say about this. I want to get a quick call in here. Tom is calling from Lake Placid, New York. You're on the air, Tom.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's your thought today?
Well, I just started teaching an iPad class for junior honor history students, and the big thing I've noticed is that it's really changed the way that they are being assessed. When I started the class, I don't quiz and test a lot anymore because we do project-based learning. And they were like, you know, quiz addicts. They needed a grade. They needed their fix. And I had to have an intervention with them like the third week in school to say, look, you are being assessed. And we're now emphasizing iterations over grades. Before, they would just chase an A or a B, and if they didn't get the grade, then they would want to follow through. But if they got a grade they liked, they would just discard it.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're focusing on the work longer, and they're doing more with the work over and over and over again. And it's really changed the whole dynamic of the class.
So for the better, you're saying?
Absolutely for the better. Their immersion in history, and history is not an easy subject when you're talking about the Federalist Papers and the Constitution, but they're getting immersed in it because they're not worried about a one-time quiz assessment where they're going to get 10 questions and they've got to do well. They're more worried about being able... I'll give you one example. We do a project on Docery, which is a video-making app, and I had one girl said, I want to show mine. And this is a girl that's kind of shy, and she was really engaged. So she showed it, and a groan went up from her peers because they were like, I wish I went first because that was so good. They have been pushing each other, and the intervention happened because they're all like, I'm putting in so much time on this. And the reason they were putting in time was not because I was telling them to, but when they looked at their peers' work, they knew they weren't holding their own. And so they were driving each other to do more. And that's just a great thing for a teacher to sit back and watch these kids push each other.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Shane Evans, there's a voice from the trenches in New York saying, yeah, it's working, and I'm seeing my students being even more engaged.
Exactly. Tom, keep up the good work, first of all. And I think he's exactly right. He spoke to something that we talked about earlier, was this natural sense of engagement. Again, students are going to get excited about learning when it speaks to them and when they also have a platform that they use. And so including technology in a way to assess, to do project-based learning, for students to demonstrate what they understand and what they comprehend about the Federalist Papers or about the American Revolution is a really authentic way. Now, that doesn't mean that we also then don't ask students to write a 3-page paper. So it is, again, both and.
Shane Evans, stand by. You're in Chicago because I want to turn momentarily to Lexington, South Carolina, where Janet Frazier is joining us. She's the mother of three. Her youngest is a 7th grader, and he has been assigned an iPad by his middle school. And Janet is also running for office for the Lexington District 1 School Board. Janet Frazier, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So you've been hearing Shane Evans talk about how tablets are transforming learning in his classrooms in Chicago. Do you feel the same way about what's happening in your school district in South Carolina?
I think they have the potential to get there where Chicago is, but right now it's completely new to parents and teachers. Our school district just finished rolling out 16,500 iPads to all middle school students and high school students.
16,000 of them. At what cost?
$379 per iPad at a cost of about $6.25 million.
I suppose some educators might say in the long run it's supposed to save money because you're not buying, textbooks as often, or you're not even using out-of-date textbooks.
Well, but we haven't gotten to that point either yet.
Mm-hmm.
And this money was part of a $15 million bond referendum that was passed by voters at the polls in 2008.
So the money has been spent. The iPads are now being handed out to students. One of them is your own son. I mean, as a parent, do you think it's a good idea? Is it making a difference in his education?
today, I don't see a difference at this particular point because they have only loaded 5 applications on their iPads for educational purposes, which is an app called Pages, Numbers, Keynote, iMovie, and GarageBand. They have not pushed down any iBooks yet. Our books are provided by the South Carolina Department of Education, and so now our children are carrying around an iPad and their textbooks.
So, I mean, do you think, I hear obviously a note of concern in your voice, Janet. I mean, do you think it's going to have an overall positive impact on education there, or is it the way that the whole program has been rolled out that you're worried about?
Well, I am concerned because I think they've rolled out the cart before the horse. For example, with all this technology on their servers, they don't have the server capacity. Their servers have been crashing. I talked to a couple of kids yesterday morning. Their iPads froze up the night before. They couldn't cut off. They couldn't do anything. So they couldn't do any work. And our children are taking these home on a daily basis. And it has become an issue because they've got a lot of games that the kids have put on there.
So they have control over what they can add to the tablet.
To a degree. They have. I know the school district blocked Facebook, but there's Instagram and there's FaceTime right now.
So, Janet, let me ask you. So there's a problem, I hear you saying, with what kids can or can't do with the iPads or the tablets at home. But do you also think that teachers have the capacity in the Lexington school districts to, you know, maximize the potential of this new technology in their class, in the classroom?
I think they will in the long run, but they need to be provided more training. My personal opinion is I think they should have rolled out the iPads to the teachers a year prior to giving them to the students.
Let me ask Shane Evans about that. I mean, you're an educator. Is that realistic to give teachers a year lead time on this technology, Shane?
Well, first of all, I think Janet is well informed about what's happening both in South Carolina with her school district, but just in general, the approach that you would take. Absolutely. I think she raises some legitimate concerns. And first and foremost, ideally, you would love to get the technology, or even if it wasn't technology, the curriculum, into the teachers and staff's hands a year, 6 months in advance so that they can become more familiar. And then also we want to make sure that there's professional development for our teachers, our staff members, and watch this, also our parents. So in some of our campuses, what we actually have is we have technology nights so that parents can also learn how to use some of these applications. We give parents the same passwords that the students have so that they can also check and use the different aspects and different apps. And I think Janet is also right to think about the fact that we have to be really intentional about making sure that we're providing support and assistance to our students, either in elementary or in middle school or in high, as to how to use tablets and laptops effectively at school and at home. Last is that it's not just the cost of the actual machines. Janet spoke to this. We have to make sure that our server capabilities are strong. We have to make sure that each campus, if they're using laptops or iPads, has someone on the ground or someone that they can at least reach out to help with technical support. And so it is a larger cost. But I also think Janet, most importantly, said that over time, this will probably be beneficial because with any new initiative, whether it's tech related or whether it's a new social studies curriculum in an old school textbook, it takes time to see the benefit of these things.
But Shane Evans, haven't we seen this before with other technologies rolled out into classroom? It's like the next big thing. It's the hot thing. Everyone wants to have it in schools. But teachers are already saying, I don't even have enough time for professional development as it is. And the idea of having my hands on technology 6 months to a year before I'm allowed to use it with my students, while it sounds great, 6 months to a year from now, that technology may be completely obsolete anyway. I mean, we're living in a world where the flow of information and development is so fast that you kind of have to use it now.
Well, it's interesting because I think schools are really supposed to prepare young people for the world that exists. And if you think about it, Meghna, that's the world that you and I exist in. So there are certain apps that right now you and I probably both use at our jobs. And in about 12 months, there might be a new way of us doing that, a new system, or a new app, a new platform, and we have to adjust. So what I think schools need to do is not just about providing the tablet or the technology. It's about, first and foremost, teaching critical thinking. So our students in a 21st century world are going to need to be able to think critically. They're going to need to be able to evaluate, analyze, and synthesize. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the technology or the platform or the app, schools should be teaching students how to do that.
Janet Fraser, you just heard Shane Evans talk about critical thinking, but I also know a lot of parents, and perhaps even you, who are concerned about the effect that tablets and the constant access to information through things like iPads have on students' social skills, which, quite frankly, is a quite important set of skills students need to learn in school. I mean, do you and other parents share that concern as well?
Yes, I am very concerned about the decrease in the social skills because they need to know how to do both. And if you only operate electronically, you are losing some of your social skills. For example, I've seen children not be able to carry on a conversation, but they can text and type all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue that I'm seeing with a lot of the iPads is I've heard parents say that their student is texting them from their iPad on FaceTime or some other method all day long while they're in class. And they're also taking pictures either in class or on the bus and posting them that way. And it's also increased the disciplinary fraction.
Mm-hmm. Janet Fraser joining us today from Lexington, South Carolina, mother of three, including a seventh grader who's been assigned an iPad by his middle school. Janet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's get another quick call in here. Anne is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Anne.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi. What's your thought today?
Well, I just wanted to share that my son is a student at Tower School in Marblehead, Massachusetts. And the Tower School began an iPad program last year. This is my son's second year using the iPad at school. He's in the eighth grade. And I just think it has been tremendous. I am astounded by how well this iPad program has gone.
What proof? I mean, what is your son actually doing that's astounding you so much?
Well, where do I begin? First of all, prior caller, I believe it was Janet mm-hmm. Fraser, and she had some concerns about social interaction if students have the iPad. I think the exact opposite is true. Certainly the use of the iPad at Tower School. At Tower School, the use of the iPad actually encourages social skills. These kids often work in groups on the iPads. They have projects that may include filming. They read on their iPads with others in the group. They read aloud in the classroom. They share documents. The access to information is phenomenal while they're reading, and I really don't know a lot about the technology of it myself.
But you're seeing that it's working for your son. And thank you so much for your call. Shane Evans, we've just got a couple seconds literally here before the break, but I just wanted to give you a quick chance to respond about the social skills question that both Janet and Anne brought up. We just got a couple seconds before the break.
Again, as we move forward, it's not either or. Students will have to continue to learn how to socialize with students, in, you know, of course, face to face and in large groups. But in the 21st century, who we are online and our ability to communicate digitally is going to be almost as important as face to face.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the big new thing in many schools across the country this year, iPads and Kindles and tablet computers, and whether they will revolutionize the 21st century classroom experience. I'm joined today by Shane Evans. He's joining us from Chicago. He's the director of the University of Chicago Charter School and supervising the implementation of technology in the charter school's four campuses. And also with us now is Daniel Willingham. He's professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He's an expert in applying new findings of cognitive psychology in K through 12 education and author of When Can You Trust the Experts? How to Tell Good Science from Bad in Education. Daniel Willingham, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Let me just start off by asking you a question that's keyed off of a comment that On Point's Facebook page received, and that's from Jonathan Michael Lloyd. He posted, "It's tragic that we've gone so overboard on tech in the classroom without insisting on proof that it helps." So cognitively? Are there measures to show us that this technology does or doesn't help kids learn in the classroom? What do we know about that?
Yeah, so when you consider a question like that, the first thing that you recognize is that the question needs to be a little bit more specific. Whether technology is good or bad, it's sort of like saying, does food help your body or not? It really depends on the type of food, right? And similarly, technology is a tool, right, like many other tools that we have at our disposal. And the extent to which it helps is really going to depend on how it's implemented. And I think in the comments of your prior guests, you really heard that, right? So on the one hand, you had Tom, the first caller, who was obviously very enthusiastic, very thoughtful about how he was implementing technology in his classroom. And it sounds like that would be a place I would want my kid to go to school. Then on the other hand, you had Janet, who was talking about implementation where basically a district had decided they were going to shower iPads on these classrooms. And teachers were not getting a whole lot of instruction about what to do with them, a lot of support in how to make good use of them. And based on what's happened in the past, it's very predictable that not much that's good is going to happen in Janet's district, I'm afraid.
Well, let me ask you, Daniel Willingham. I mean, anyone who's watched a young person use a smartphone or a tablet computer knows that there's maybe something about a young person's brain and the just sheer intuitiveness of the use of these devices, the touchscreen, the personal, you know, nature of it, the speed with which they pick up just how to use it is absolutely remarkable. So is there something about the nature of the way children or young people learn when they're, say, you know, between the ages of 5 and 15, I'm just throwing that out there, that mm-hmm. could make these powerful teaching tools?
I think what you're responding to is something slightly different than what we want kids to be learning, right? So they do seem to learn how to deal with the software, the interface, very, very rapidly. And that's really the people who deserve a hat tip there are the software designers, right, who are designing it to be very intuitive and very easy to use. And older folks like me may be a little bit slower, but there may be other reasons for that. But we shouldn't be overly impressed by that in a way or seduced by that because this is not really the content that we want kids to learn. I mean, we do want them to know how to use basic programs, but that's relatively easy. What's harder is leveraging that into learning reading comprehension, math, science, and critical thinking skills, as Shane was emphasizing.
Daniel Willingham and Shane Evans, I'm going to bring you back here in a second, but I've heard this critical thinking and the importance of it a couple times in this conversation now. And it makes me wonder, I mean, critical thinking means, yes, how do we analyze, how do we parse and judge the relative accuracy and importance of the information that's coming at us? That is a skill that's as important as it's ever been in human life. But there's also the question of basic knowledge and the foundation upon which we make these judgments, because I'm wondering, there was a 2005 University of Connecticut experiment, I believe, where a researcher set up a website that looked very scientific about the Pacific Northwest tree octopus, right? This is not a
right.
thing that exists, but the website right. made it look official. And of the students that were tested, every single one of them except one said the website was legit because it looked right to them. And the question is here, they just didn't know enough about basic marine biology to be like, there's no way that an octopus can exist in a tree whose, according to this website, chief predator is a Sasquatch.
Right.
So Daniel Willingham, let me start with you. I mean, it's this question of, you know, critical thinking, important, but what also about foundational knowledge that schools are supposed to be, you know, imbuing into our children?
I think you're right on the money in your comment. So the idea that critical thinking can be taught completely divorced from content knowledge sounds really good, but I think it's a myth. Critical thinking in the first place is somewhat discipline specific. So thinking critically in science, for example, is not the same thing as thinking critically about literature. But even there, you need a basis in science in order to deploy the critical thinking skills that you're taught. So, for example, knowing how to set up an experiment, what it means to have a control group. You can't know whether or not the control group is the right control group unless you're already familiar with the basic scientific literature in the area that you're studying. So I think it's inaccurate to think of either one separate. It's easy to appreciate that you don't want to just acquire facts and not know how to use them in skills. Everybody sort of gets that. Mm-hmm. But we don't seem to always appreciate that critical thinking skills without any facts, that's just impossible. So they're really intertwined.
Shane Evans, let me hear from you on this.
So I think that the website example is a good one. I think about textbooks in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and standard textbooks probably didn't talk a lot about African Americans. They probably didn't talk a lot about Mexican Americans. They might not have talked a lot about women's suffrage. And if you think about it, for years, textbooks just gave their supposedly factual point of view about history. And it was just one version of history. And then you waited for the most recent textbook to include more evidence or more opinions or more perspective. But at that time, that's what we accepted for educational fact and what students would learn, and they would regurgitate that information. As Daniel said, they would have content, but they might not have the critical thinking ability to actually say, well, really, did Lincoln free the slaves? Because if the South had already seceded, how was he able to tell them what to do? Whereas with the use of technology, a textbook and a tablet, a student has the ability to look at the textbook, see what the textbook states to be the case, and then cruise seven different sites to see what those sites would say. Now, with the example of the website that you spoke of, what schools and families must do is to ensure that their students understand and develop the ability to assess a website's validity.
Shane, let me jump in here, because you mentioned this earlier about parent needing parental training because this technology is going home with kids. And you just said it again, that schools and families have to be part of this educational process. So how is it that parents should be trained or should be training themselves to manage this technology at home?
So I think that what the best case examples of schools doing a good job with this is to incorporate parent learning in this process as well. So in the beginning of the school year, when you're getting ready to launch an iPad initiative or a laptop initiative, what you would want to have to do is an informational session for each parent. The parent, again, becomes familiar with the websites, becomes familiar with the curriculum, both the traditional curriculum that's used in our textbooks, but also the curriculum that might be used online. You would have availability for parents to come in to your school and possibly get more training, whether through a computer-based room or through a parent room that has access to technology, and ongoing support during the school year.
I also don't mean to make light of this, but do you train parents on how to take the iPad away?
Well,
I mean, I think it's a serious issue, right? If they're never putting it down and you're not quite sure they're doing their homework on it.
Well, I think I have a six-year-old, obviously. Janet spoke to this. And what we've told parents in our schools is that, remember, these were your fees that might have paid for this lease program. So if a student isn't using it, as Daniel said again, it's a tool. If the student isn't using it effectively, or if the school system isn't using it effectively, then any parent, whether individual or group, would need to have a conversation with their parent or with the school district so that the technology can be used in a helpful way, not a harmful way.
Shane Evans in Chicago, stand by, and Daniel Willingham in Charlottesville, Virginia, stand by for just a moment. Tons of people want to have a say on this iPads in the classroom issue, so let's bring them into the conversation. Steve is calling from Toronto, Canada. You're on the air, Steve.
Hello. I'm entirely appalled by what I've heard. I mean, this is just the wrong direction to go in. Someone said killer app. These are killer apps, but what they're killing is education, the learning on the student side, and they're killing the teaching. It's essentially masking a failure of teaching and a failure of learning, not to mention insufficient resources within these systems. You've got people now having to shell out money, school systems who will have to shell out money, or the alternative is what, more, you know, of a corporate presence. It's bad enough that the televisions are in there now, and have been for quite a while, pushing all sorts of nonsense to these children. You need to go back to the basics, and to the extent you're able to do that, the more learning there will be, and the more the teaching will have to be there, because as long as you've got this technology as a cover, the learning is not going to happen, and the teaching will just continue to be deficient.
Steve, let me ask you, though. I mean, for many students' lives, this technology is already ubiquitous. It is there, whether, you know, it's there outside the classroom. So are schools at risk of basically being out of touch if, for, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day, students are thinking, this is boring, because as soon as I go home, I can actually do something else on my tablet?
But this is incredible. This whole problem with it being boring, that right there should be a big clue. Do you want to encourage more of that? Do we want more problems with attention, with concentration, which is what technology will do? It will encourage all these different issues. Do we just drug up the kids on Ritalin and everything else and expect that to solve it, while at the same time we're doing the opposite and encouraging the problem by bringing in more of this ridiculous technology, this toxic technology? You need to clean up this environment, get rid of this this obsession we have with the technology, and go back to the basics. Compare to the education levels, achievement levels of students. If you go back, 40, mm-hmm. 50, 60 years, talk to people who went through that. They're quite old now, and ask them what that experience was like, what they had learned by, say, grade 6. And then take a look at where children are now.
Steve, let's pick up on that point, because I do want to let Shane Evans and Daniel Willingham respond to that. And we hear your passion about it. Steve, thank you so much for your call. So, Daniel Willingham, let's start with you. I mean, Steve sees this as masking bad teaching.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. And again, I would reiterate. I mean, there are ways, and it's being done now. There are ways of using these new technologies in classrooms that are productive for kids, that are exciting for kids, and it's definitely positive. On the other hand, he's got a point that it's perfectly possible that it's going to be used in ways that are not productive. And this is really my main take on this. I think it's a mistake to either see this as the coming of the apocalypse or as the silver bullet that's going to solve all of our educational problems. Meghna, you said earlier, it feels like we've been here before, and we absolutely have. This is not the first wave of excitement about computing. The first wave was really in the early and mid-70s, and the death knell for that wave sort of happened in the mid-90s. And when people looked back and tried to figure out what went wrong, they came up with some reasonable guesses as to the problems. A lot of it concerned software, that the software just was hard to find applications that were both really engaging and also educational for kids. So we need to do a better job of that.
You know, gentlemen, I'm sorry to cut you off there, Daniel, but in the last couple of minutes that we have, Steve's call really got me thinking about how this technology in particular, these tablets, really are on the cusp of, they are changing the way we live, you know, whether it's in school or not. So they are bound to have a profound impact on, the purpose. Maybe I'm going too far in saying this, but I'm going to do it anyway. The purpose of education, because, I wonder, in a world where we have instant information, instant gratification, there's a line of thinking that says what we need to do is teach children how to be good decision makers to cope with all this information. There's another line of thinking, and Shane, I'll turn this to you, that schools should be in the business of training excellence and expertise, and that takes deep focus and a lack of distraction. So, I mean, is it fair to say that is one more valuable than the other in the 21st century, Shane?
I think that's where schools get into trouble, is when they start trying to say which is more valuable. And again, I think I want to reiterate it's both and. So we have to be able to prepare students to make good choices about what to do with their time, what websites to look at, what programs to use and can be beneficial, while at the same time develop their expertise. There was an NPR story on yesterday that mentioned about the reading habits of young people ages 16 to 30, and that 8 out of 10 of them had read a book within the past year, and that was in comparison to adults, where it was 7 out of 10. And so, to the caller's point, it seems that the younger generation is reading more than the older generation. Second of all, I think what technology allows us is multiple formats to read. In the past, all you could read was a book or a magazine, right? But now you can read on your smartphone, you can read an e-reader, you can read on a tablet. There are 10,000 free books on an iPad. Talk to a student from a low-income neighborhood across the country. If they don't have books in their household, but their school has an iPad, they've got 10,000 books in front of them at their fingertips. Mm-hmm. And last, if you think about it, there's an ongoing joke that Rip Van Winkle wakes up in the school, right? And he's like, wow, I don't realize what century this is. It must be the same. It looks the same. Everyone was different. Everything else that I saw was different, except for the one place I recognized, which was a school. Daniel, and so if schools don't transform and catch up into the 21st century, we're going to lose our young people, and we're not going to prepare them for an ever-changing world.
Daniel Willingham, let me close with you here. We just got a minute to go or so. I imagine a lot of parents are hearing this thinking, I know this is coming, it's already in my school, but at the end of the day, there's a practical concern. The tablet, as we were talking about earlier, the tablets come home. So the learning still continues at home with this technology. So, I mean, do you have, in a couple seconds, practical advice on what parents should do to, you know, supervise homework on the tablets, to, you know, control the or influence the use of these things at home?
Sure, I can be very brief. One is, I think your point, you know, take it away if necessary, is, I think, well-founded. But to know whether that's necessary, you really need to be observant and you need to be in the room with the child and seeing what they're doing. The second thing I would add is, don't let them multitask if you actually want them to get some work done. This is the one thing the psychologists are quite certain about new technologies, is this propensity kids have to multitask really does impair their ability to get work done.
Daniel Willingham is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He joins us today from Charlottesville, Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Shane Evans, director of the University of Chicago Charter School, joining us today from Chicago. Shane, such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Meghna, thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.